Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. Wow, thank you so much for coming. I'm sorry it's a bit cozy, but we're all here because we love Lisa C., so that's a good reason. We can live. I'm really excited to introduce her, especially for this book, Dreams of Joy, because I introduced Shanghai Girls and quite a few other of her books, and I love her writing. They always keep me right inside the world of China, and I learn so much from them, and it's just always a pleasure to read Lisa C. So if you remember, Shanghai Girls left off with the daughter Joy, and she'd run away, and she's going to China. So Dreams of Joy starts pretty much right where it left off, and it's kind of interesting to me because it takes place in the period of Mao's Cultural Revolution, actually before that, the Great Leap Forward, or as I've now named it, the Great Famine of Death, because it sure was. And I just really appreciate all the characters and how the innocence of Joy brought to me the innocence of the people during this really rough time. This book debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list the second it came out. So please welcome Lisa C.
Thank you, Lisa. And my God, look at how many people are here. Before I talk about the book, I just want to take a moment to say thank you to Tattered Cover. You know, I have come here not to this store, but to Tattered Cover for every single book. For On Gold Mountain, I think there were about four people there. And you still invited me back, so thank you. You know, we all know that independent bookstores are in trouble. And the hardcover book, you know, actual books are in trouble. But it's stores like this that keep writers going, and it's stores like this that can provide events like this. And clearly, you all are supporting your independent bookstore by being here. But I want to just say that it's not enough to show up. You have to buy something. And you do not have to buy Dreams of Joy. But I hope that you will buy something tonight, because that's the only way that you can have events like this, that you can have stores like this, that you can actually have access to books where you actually can hold them in your hand before you decide to buy them. Okay, so that's just my little lecture. You just have to bear with me. All right, I'm just going to go back in time for a minute. A few years back, I was just turned 50 or was about to turn 50. I was on vacation with my family. My older son had just graduated from college. My younger son was going to college. And I was sort of a little blue about all of that. Who wouldn't be? And there we were sitting on the beach, you know, Hawaii, how bad could it be? And my older son, who had just graduated from Stanford, said, I'm past my prime. And we spent the next week trying to cheer him up. You know, we would say, oh, your dad, he didn't hit his prime till he was 35. And, you know, your grandpa, he hit his prime when he was 42. And your grandma, she really hit her prime when she was 40. And he did start to perk up. But the more he perked up, the more depressed I got. Because I realized I'd never had a prime. And there was one night at dinner, you know, I just said, you know, to everybody, I said, you know, I don't think I've ever had a prime. And they all looked at me and I said, yep, you haven't. And so it was really with that in my mind turning 50. My older son graduated. My younger son gone. Being a, what's known as a critically acclaimed writer. I had written 4 books. Critically acclaimed. Do you know what that means? You get really good reviews, but nobody reads your books. All right, so it was with that in my mind that I started working on Snowflower and the Secret Fan. And everyone said to me as I was working on that book, oh, Lisa, no one's going to read it. And they just all said it, you know, my friends, my family, my editor, my publisher, my agent, other writers I knew, every single person said, no one's going to read this book. And that was actually this incredible freeing thing. It allowed me to just go very deep inside myself and write this book that I just thought, well, no one's going to read it. I might as well just write what I want. And it turned out everyone was wrong, right? Everyone was wrong. And so what happens then when you have this kind of overnight success, whether it's overnight after 10 books or overnight after a first book? So there are different things. Sometimes writers, they sort of join the jet set and they go all over the world and have a good time. Sometimes they say, that's it, I'll rest on my laurels, I'll never write another book again, Harper Lee. Sometimes people say, well, that worked. I'll just write the same book over and over and over again. But here's what happened to me. People started coming to events. People started writing to me through my website. I have a website. There's a place that says Write Lisa. It comes right to me. I'm the only one who reads them. I'm the only one who answers. How many people here have had emails from me? Well, don't be shy. I know it's more than 2. I know. Yeah, okay. So I join a lot of book clubs by speakerphone and by Skype. And so over the years, what has happened... Ooh, I know. It's so exciting. Over the years, what has happened is that all of you have given me courage to write deeper, to go deeper, to do what Chinese women writers in the 17th century said, cut to the bone. That was what they really felt you needed to do to write. And that's not an easy thing to do. And it's certainly not something that I wake up in the morning and think, you know, oh, goody, I get to go cut to the bone. So it does take a fair amount of courage, and it takes a fair amount of, you know, persistence, I suppose. But it's really only because all of you have given me that courage to do it. So really, thank you so much. I really mean it. Thank you. Okay. All right. So dreams of joy. I've been thinking of dreams of joy in terms of 4 aphorisms. You know I like to use a lot of aphorisms in my books. I collect them. I keep them in little notebooks. And the first of these is the dead can claim the living. As Lisa said in the introduction, this book picks up right where Shanghai Girls left off. If you haven't read that book, don't worry. There's a little 3-page synopsis right at the beginning that's going to catch you right up. If you read it a couple of years ago and you're a little hazy about what happened, don't worry. There's that little 3-page synopsis right at the beginning that's going to catch you right up. And so here is Joy, 19 years old. She has just discovered certain things, that the woman she thought was her mother is actually her aunt. The woman she thought is her aunt is actually her mother. Her beloved father, who she loves so much, has recently committed suicide. Well, he's not her father. It's actually an artist living in China. And so in this moment of sorrow and grief and guilt and some anger and some idealism, she runs away to the People's Republic of China. It's 1957, probably not the best idea. I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that by about page 20, she actually has found her father, and they go out to the countryside to a village called Green Dragon, where they stay in a 29-bedroom villa where they're going to teach peasants art. Okay, I have to just stop right there and name drop for a minute. When I started this book, I knew that I wanted to have part of it set in Shanghai and part of it set in a small village. Now, I don't know how many of you know much about Chinese written characters, but they have a lot of depth to them. This is one of the things that makes written Chinese very different from any other language, that you can look at a character and you see back behind it all of these literary allusions and historical moments. And so let's just take a word like river. So river, you know, a little body of water running through it, okay? And that's how we would see it. Maybe you visualize a river or something like that. But in Chinese, you would look at that written character and you would think about every time a poet had used it, if Li Bai had used it in one of his drinking poems, if it's been used in an opera, if it's been used in a piece of, in a novel, you would remember the moments where in history where there'd been some battle on a particular river that it would have all of this resonance to it. And so when I was looking for a village, I really wanted it to be in Anhui province, because Anhui has this history of poverty, famine, drought, flood. It's where Pearl Buck set the good earth. And so I thought, well, maybe other people aren't going to know this, but I would know it. And so I had started to look for a small village in Anhui when one day I get a phone call from Amy Tan. That's the name drop, okay? And she says, I'm doing research on a novel, and I have just been invited to stay in a 17th century 29-bedroom villa in a small village in Anhui province. Would you like to come? And so off we went to this village called Wangsun, and we stayed in this, you know, fabulous villa. Although I have to tell you, a villa, a 17th century villa in China is not at all the same as a 17th century villa in Tuscany or France, you know. No windows, no heat, no hot water, no indoor plumbing. It was really quite an adventure. But the villa that is in Dreams of Joy is based very loosely on that villa, and the village of Green Dragon is based very loosely on Wangsun. Okay, so she's out there in the countryside. Meanwhile, her mother, Pearl, is reeling from a lot of these same revelations as her daughter, except that she also is a recent widow, which brings me to the second of these aphorisms, which is, suffering will overcome attachment by wearing it out. In Chinese tradition, there are certain rules for widows. That you should live in chastity for the rest of your life, that you should spend the rest of your life in prayer and fasting, and that you should give up all material possessions. And through all of this suffering, you will overcome attachment by wearing it out. But Pearl can't give up attachment if it means giving up on her daughter. And so she, too, runs off to China in search of joy. And it's really through Pearl that I wanted to look at all of our preconceptions and maybe misconceptions of what China was like in those days. When I told my mom I was going to write this book, she said, and you know, when it was set, she said, you know, this is going to be the shortest book you've ever written. Pearl and Joy get off the plane, they're taken out back and shot, the end. And so I knew I was going to have to deal with that, you know, that we have all thought of China in those days as being closed, right? President Nixon went to China in the 70s and he opened China. That meant it was closed. But it wasn't as closed as we've all been led to believe. It was a bamboo curtain, not an iron curtain. And so bamboo, what? You can see through it. You can slip through it. It's pliable. It's flexible. And so there were a lot of people going to China in those days. Some coming out, but a lot of people going in. There were a lot of Westerners who stayed in China, never left. Shell Oil never left. There, I just met a woman the other day in Miami. She had been born from England. She had been born in Shanghai. Her father decided to stay after 1949 because he had a business there, and they stayed until 1962. You all know Goldman Sachs. Mr. Sachs's daughter was one of the people, young people, who ran off to China, and she ended up staying there until she was in her 90s. You can imagine the dinner conversations they must have had, you know, little different ideas of politics and money and stuff. But there were also a lot of Chinese, ethnic Chinese from around the world who returned to China. And I don't think that they were going back necessarily to build a communist state. They were going back because this was their home country. It was a place that was brand new, only, you know, a year old, 2 years old, at this point, 8 years old. And they were filled with this desire, just as I think all of us would be, if there for some strange reason was a big regime change here in this country, that we would want to come here and help to rebuild it. And so these were vast, vast numbers of people. 90,000 people returned to Fujian province, one province alone, in 1 year. So large, large numbers of people. Now, when you went back, there were certain things you had to do. You had to turn in your passport and declare yourself stateless. If you were a woman, you had to turn in all of your bras because they were considered bourgeois, decadent, imperialistic. So not a lot of bras in this book. Okay? Now, it's not long after they get there that it's the launch of the Great Leap Forward. As I talk about this, and you know I always have a lot of history in my books, and you know that I'm interested in stories that have been lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up, and this is such a good example of that. And it really has not been written about very much. There are about four book nonfiction books on the Great Leap Forward, and to my knowledge, no other novel in English or even Chinese has been set in this period. And when I was there in China doing research and in the cities, and young people would say, well, what are you working on? And I would tell them, I'm working on a novel about the Great Leap Forward. They would say, oh, yes, the 3 years of bad weather. So just keep that in mind as I tell you what really happened. So in 1958, Mao goes to Moscow. It's just after the launch of Sputnik. He's completely inspired. He returns and launches the Great Leap Forward. The goal was that within 15 years, China would overtake, surpass Great Britain in terms of steel production and agricultural production. A few weeks later, he said, let's do it in 7 years. A couple of weeks later, he said, let's do it in two. A couple of weeks after that, he said, forget Great Britain. Now China is going to overtake the United States in terms of steel and agriculture within 2 years. And so now there were these two big campaigns with some little mini campaigns in between. So first, steel. People went through their houses, their schools, where they worked, through factories, and gathered all the metal that they could find. They took these little metal lamps. They took the metal chairs. They took the door hinges. They took all of their cooking utensils. They took all of their farm implements. They took hairpins. And they took these things out to the backyard, melted them in what were called backyard furnaces into pig iron, which was then sent to the government to turn into steel. It didn't work, okay? It didn't work. But there was an unintended consequence of melting down all of your cooking utensils and farm implements. Okay, that gives you the steel. On the agriculture side, a country that for 5,000 years had been growing rice, they decided, hi, here's a good idea. Let's grow wheat instead. And so they had what I can only call kind of cockamamie ideas about how to do this. Instead of using actual fertilizer, as they'd been using for 5,000 years, they would send broken glass from the cities out to the countryside where people would grind it down and then use that as a nutrient in the soil. The people who were doing that work maybe didn't own a pair of shoes, maybe had never even owned a pair of sandals. The instead of planting one seed in a spot, they were ordered to do what was called dense planting, putting 10 seeds in one spot. The idea was that you would get 10 times the amount of radishes, 10 times the amount of cabbage, 10 times the amount of wheat. Well, anybody who's ever grown anything will know that that wouldn't work, but they did it nevertheless. There were these little mini campaigns, as I said, and one of them was called the elimination of the four pests. And the four pests were insects, flies that got their own special category, rats, and sparrows. And so all across the country, 24 hours a day, people were outside banging things together so that these sparrows would fly, 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 never being allowed to land until finally they would drop dead out of the sky from exhaustion. The theory was that they won't eat the seeds as we plant them. The unintended consequence was, as things started to grow, there was no natural predator for the bugs that came and ate the produce. Another of the campaigns was to double the population of China as quickly as possible. Just pop out babies, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as fast as you can. The idea was, with every new stomach comes a new pair of hands to help build the country. But there was another reason. China was very worried that the United States was going to drop nuclear bombs. And so the theory was, if we can double our population, when the U.S. drops bombs on us, we will have enough survivors that we'll be able to replenish our population quickly. The unintended consequence of this doesn't show up for about 20 years, the one-child policy, right? Okay. And then they could have another campaign. Exactly. So all of this results in this unbelievable famine. And scholars have been arguing now for years how many people died. Was it 10 million? Was it 100 million? And recent documents released by the People's Republic of China seem to suggest that it was 45 million people who starved to death in 3 years. All right, so that gives you a sense of some of the history. But obviously what my books are really about are relationships and emotions. And in this book, what I've written about is mother love and a story between a mother and a daughter, which brings me to the third of these aphorisms. Mothers suffer, children do what they want. Now, these books are not autobiographical in the traditional sense. I don't base certain characters on people that I know. But the emotional life of these characters comes very much from my own life. And I don't think that there's anyone here who is related to me or to my son or to my new daughter-in-law. So I'm going to tell you a story, but please don't repeat it, okay? And if I see it on the internet or something, I will hunt you down, okay? So last summer, my son gets married. Now, you know, as the mother of the bride, there are certain rules. Wear beige, keep your mouth shut. Well, that's just a big fat lie. And this was going to be a destination wedding in Napa in summer when it would be about 118 degrees. And because it was a destination wedding, instead of having just a regular rehearsal dinner, we needed to give a welcome dinner for everyone, all 125 people who were flying in from all over the world, which was fine. We were happy to do it. But Alexander comes to us one night and he says, you know, You really need to have a theme for the welcome dinner. And I said, honey, you aren't 7. We don't need Batman or Superman. Now, you can see right off the bat that I just, you know, was not in a good frame of mind from the beginning. This is not about how impossible he was necessarily, although he was. Okay. But I was pretty impossible, too. So the first theme that he came up with was a Hawaiian luau in Napa in summer, 118 degrees. And the reason was he wanted to have a whole roast suckling pig. And a third of the guests, Chinese, they would be so down with that roast suckling pig. You know, you cannot have a Chinese meal without plenty of pork. The next third of the guests, Jewish. The last third of the guests, Muslim. All right, so that got pushed away. Next, it was going to be a Southern barbecue. Now, we have no reason to have a Southern barbecue, just like we had no reason to have a Hawaiian luau. But they thought, Alexander and Elizabeth, that it would really be fun to have three stations in Napa in summer, 118 degrees, grits three ways. Another station with southern vegetables, okra, lima beans, and then the last one, pork, three ways. So we hadn't made much progress. I said, well, okay, why can't we have something that at least represents our family? And I do have this theory about parties that you should have food that people can eat, right? So I said, what if we do Hong Kong, 1957? We'll hang some lanterns. We'll have a big buffet. If people don't want to eat pork, they can eat chicken. If they don't want chicken, they can eat duck. If they don't want those things, we'll have plenty of vegetables. Alexander loved it. The next day, I get a phone call from him. Mom, how could you have been so cruel and insensitive? Now, I don't know how I could have been so cruel and insensitive, and I needed to have it explained to me. There were a lot of people coming to this wedding from Iran, and this would really hurt their feelings to be reminded of British imperialism. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I thought it was a bit of a stretch, but, you know, you still don't want to hurt the new in-laws' feelings. So that was gone. Then they came up with, this was not the last idea, but we were getting closer to the last idea, an all-white party. All white decorations. Everybody wears white. All the music has the word white in it. I said, do you mean like white Christmas? And he said, absolutely, because Elizabeth, I love her, daughter-in-law, she loves Christmas carols. She actually listens to them all year. I mean, she's very sweet, but that's a weird quirk. And white Christmas is her favorite. And then what's the last piece of a party? The food. All white food. It's so disgusting. So all last summer, I was walking with my friend Millie. And Millie's son, Adam, was also getting married. And that wedding made our wedding look like a walk in the park. I mean, every weird thing that could happen in that wedding happened. And so we would walk every Friday for 5 miles at the end of the day. And we'd be walking. And we just would be so upset, and we would be saying things like, how could he have come out of my body? You know, he doesn't love us anymore. And then we would drink a lot of vodka and feel a lot better. But one day when we were walking, she said, you know, sometimes when you're a mother, you have to imagine that there's this angel sitting on your shoulder who is going to, when your child does something really crazy or really wrong or really wrong-headed or really stubborn or you just plain old don't like, which, of course, all kids do, that you will listen to this angel and you will say the exact right thing. And when Alexander said, all white food, I did not listen to that angel. I said some pretty terrible things. So, mothers suffer and children do what they want. So, what is the true depth of motherhood? Really, what is it? First, sacrifice. That you would do anything to protect your child, to make sure that they are okay, to make sure that they live in, you know, war, in a famine, you would do anything for them. Courage, that sometimes you have to show unbelievable courage to be a mother, to take care of your child, to provide for them. And lastly, loyalty, that there is no one who will stand by you and next to you more loyal than your own mother. Now, I know that there are a lot of people here who probably don't have children, but I'm pretty sure everyone here had a mother. And so, you know, these things, you can look at your mother and see these attributes in her. And I know my own mother, when I was growing up, she used to say to me, you know, even if you become an axe murderer, I'll still love you. I haven't become one yet, but I have time. Okay, so when I wrote this book, I was thinking of it in two parts. The first part is about finding joy, the daughter, and the second part is about finding joy, the emotion. Now, my books, I think, are not known for happy endings, and that they often have a lot of sad scenes. I get a lot of email from people saying, you know, I was in the subway, on a train, in the airplane, by the pool, at a resort, on the beach, and I was crying so hard, and when I was reading your book, that some total stranger walked up and asked, are you okay? Or, and I do get this at least once a week, an email that will say, I was in bed last night reading your book, and I was crying so hard that my husband took it away from me. But here's the thing, I never cry when I'm writing these books. I've never cried until this book. And it does have a happy ending. I wanted a happy ending for these people. I thought that they really deserved it. I'd never really written a happy ending. And there's a place about three quarters of the way through you're going to think there is no way there's going to be a happy ending. But I promise you, there is. And so when you write a book, you write the first draft and then you go through, you know, another six drafts and you turn it in and the editor sends back, you know, and you do another six drafts and then you have copy editing and page proofs and all of this stuff so that by the time it comes out, you know, I will have seen a manuscript, I don't know, 20, 30 times. But even now, there's this one line, 1.5 pages from the end, that every time I come up to it, this weird stuff starts to come out of my eyes. I just cry every single time. Which brings me to the last of these aphorisms. And this is something that someone wrote to me just before I started on the tour. Someone from China who said that my work really reminded her of the writings of Lin Yutang, who wrote, there is soft happiness in sadness and deep sadness in happiness. And I really believe that that's true. And so I hope that when you come to the end of Dreams of Joy, that you find yourself in tears, not in sadness, but in the celebration of the triumph of happiness over sadness, in the knowledge that family matters, that family is the only thing that matters, and that there can, in fact, be joy and happiness in life. Thank you. So we have some time for questions. Yes. Oh, so what was the rehearsal dinner? So, like I said earlier, I really think it's important to have food that you can eat. And we have a house here in Colorado, and our favorite restaurant here is 689 in Carbondale. I don't know if any of you, yeah. So I said, what if we did, you know, one station that's based on that restaurant that has Colorado lamb, Colorado corn, Colorado peaches. And then in a moment of semi-brilliance, I said to Alexander, where do you and Elizabeth like to vacation? Hawaii. So now we had, you know, even some pig. What can I say? And then in my true moment of actual brilliance, I said, where do Elizabeth's parents like to vacation? And it was the Bahamas. So we had little plates. People could wander from place to place. I guess our theme was vacation? I don't know. But we didn't really have any decorations other than the native flowers from each place, from Colorado, the Bahamas, which I can't even remember what those were, but we looked them up on the internet, and then Hawaii. Yes.
I look forward to reading this book because I really was disappointed at the end of Shanghai Girls. It just felt really incomplete. So I'm glad. And then the other thing, is there a special story about your dress? It looks like fans or almost a...
Okay, so two questions. First, second one was about the dress, and the first one was about the end of Shanghai Girls. I just want to say one thing about this dress. I love this dress. I'm really so crazy about this dress, and I've been on tour for a month, and I've been wearing it a lot. And it is only today here in Colorado that you are now the fourth person to say you like this dress. So obviously, people in Colorado have very good taste. But I think that's weird. It's like no place else, and no one ever said anything about it. I think they're poppies. That's what I think, but I don't know. So the end, that she was a little disappointed with the end of Shanghai Girls. Now, to me, the end was a new beginning, and I didn't think I would write a sequel. I mean, I just had no intention of writing a sequel. Now, that said, when I first plotted out Shanghai Girls, I thought it would go from 1937 to 2007. And I got about 100 pages in, and I was still in 1937, still in Shanghai. So I had to sort of stop and take a look at everything. And one of the things that I really wanted to write was about the confession program of 1957. And I felt that if I didn't write that then, that I might not ever have a chance, because I wanted to go out and find people whose families had been affected by the confession program. And those people aren't getting any younger, you know, so I really felt this sort of time crunch. But again, to me, the end was a new beginning, and I was done, and I had three other ideas that I was thinking about writing. I wrote them up. I sent them to my publisher. I went back to New York to meet with my editor, and we were sitting in his office sort of going through these different ideas when the actual publisher of Random House came in, and she said, you know, we really want you to write those other stories one of these days, but first you have to write the sequel. And I have to tell you, I really resisted, because I liked the end of the other, you know, Shanghai Girls. So the end was a new beginning. But I am nothing if not an obedient Chinese daughter. And so I went home and started doing the research. And as I started this research, and especially as I got into the stuff about the Great Leap Forward, I thought, well, this is just perfect for me. You know, this is so perfect. And so I started, you know, doing the research. I'd even started writing the book when then finally Shanghai Girls came out. And at the very first event, the very first question was from someone who had read an advanced copy. And that question was, are you going to write the sequel? And that turned out to be the first or second question at every bookstore, from every book club, from every email, from every interview, all the way up until a month ago. And, you know, I don't know what that means. It either means I'm getting better as a writer, or I truly don't know what I'm doing. Yes?
Yes, ma'am. I was going to ask, with that said and that being a segue, could this be a trilogy?
Could this be a trilogy? Yeah, sure, it could, but it's not what I'm writing next. But yes?
I always wondered about your family's antique shop. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a business. Yes, yeah, so my family's antique shop. Can you visit it? And yes, absolutely you can, although I have to tell you that there are some strange sea business practices, and one of them is they aren't open very often. They also don't like to sell things. I mean, they have these really sort of funny things, you know, but it makes it an interesting place to visit. Well, it's probably a good idea to call to say you're coming, because sometimes they're there, but even it will say, you know, like, we're open 10 to 3. So, no. Then, no. Some days they are. So, yeah, send them. Yeah. Yes.
I want to know about the movie. How true is it? Did they stay to the book? And how much influence did you have?
Okay, so the movie. How true is it to the book, and how much influence did I have? The part that is true, well, first of all, they sent me every version of the script. I would write them these long emails, what I liked, what I didn't like, my suggestions. They listened to me about 20% of the time. Now, that's what I've been saying. However, in the trailer, which is about a minute and a half, there's a line that I suggested and a scene that I suggested. So I could be completely wrong on that 20%. The part that is true to the book is absolutely true to the book. It's like they snipped scenes out of the book and just put them up there. And it's really amazing for me to see these characters, to see these scenes, to see my words right up there on the screen. The part that takes place in the past, they have done that in Chinese, so I actually am literally seeing my words on the screen because they're subtitles. But there have been a few changes. So if I tell you that there is a scene that has Hugh Jackman singing and dancing, you will know that there have been some changes. They created a modern story of friendship that takes place in Shanghai today. One of the girls is the great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Snowflower, and this story kind of weaves through the original story. And I think there's some pretty interesting things about it, and people have already been saying things to me like, you know, how could you let them touch your book? How could you let them do that to your book? Here's the thing. They've done nothing to the book. The book is still right there on the shelf. A book is its own art form. It's its own compact little thing. And a film is a completely different other art form. And we all know that when they make a movie, they make changes. And how, you know, I go to movies too, and how many times have we all gone to movies that were based on a book, and then when you come out, what do you say? Yeah. So that's the given. You know, that's the given. But I hope people will sort of look at it with an open mind, and I think there's some things in this modern part of the story that are really terrific. Yes. Oh, so she, first of all, she likes On Gold Mountain, which is about my family. And then she asked, are there other authors in my family? And yes, my mother is a writer. My mother is Carolyn C. She's written about a dozen books. And then actually my mother's father was a writer as well. So we come from a good, you know, solid line of writers. I feel like I've had a lifelong apprenticeship. And I, you know, sometimes say, but I guess I'm going to say it right now, it's a good thing they weren't plumbers.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.